Mini episode 999 of the FDH Lounge is brought to you by Sportsology, delivering unconventional columns and webcasts about sports, TV, music, movies, and more. Follow them on the web at sportsology.com.
The FDH Lounge. You want to schedule your life around it.
A long time ago, on a gloomy, wet Cleveland spring night, two men stand alone amidst the late night drizzle. Their voices echo across the vacant station parking lot as they debate the merits of the great American radio show that have been missing for far too long. On that night, an idea was born. That idea became the FDH Lounge. Welcome to the FDH Lounge.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to FDH Lounge, mini episode number 999. This is FDH Managing Partner Rick Morris here. And as befits a number like 999, we try to make these ones a big occasion, not just 500 or 750 or 1,000, but to try to do the ones around it in a big kind of a way as well. So there was an idea conceptualized recently. There was a longtime friend of the show, a true FDH Lounge dignitary who we hadn't had on for some period of time, much to my regret. So we get to fill this gap today, getting him back on, but doing it in a big way, a way that really befits the occasion of both his return to the show and also mini episode number 999. It's been 35 years since his first TV column, 35 years in July, that is. So we are coming up on that anniversary. And somebody who, again, in the course of the show, we've done the 999 mini episodes, but also the 152 full-length episodes before that from 2007 to 2011. And in 2009, which was really sort of the tipping point year for this show in terms of when we were really stepping up the star power with the guests, he was part of that wave that came in that year. And as he remarked to me last week off the air, that was also the year that Bob Barker and J.J. Dillon of pro wrestling legend, that they were on the same night. And that is a sort of an encapsulation of the FDH Lounge, I think, and all that we cover. And my discussions with this gentleman have just been a great pleasure over a period of time. And in the course, again, of speaking with him off air last week, he was, again, kind enough to let me know how much these conversations have meant to him, which is, again, something that I really respect. And to know how somebody that I respect this much respects me back and the program, while I knew that on some level, it's always great to hear it. This is a very, very accomplished gentleman. 18 years at the New York Post as TV editor and TV columnist, among many other things that he's done in the course of his career, not least of which the great memoirs, of course, Jerk, How I Wasted My Life Watching Television. That is a great book as well. And again, presently you can find his content at MediaPost.com and TVHowl.com. I could only be speaking of a good friend of the show and of mine, Adam Buckman. Adam, it's a pleasure to get you back in on the occasion of your 35th anniversary of writing TV columns. I look forward to discussing all that's happened in those 35 years and the changes you've seen.
Well, it's so great to be back, Rick, and really, thank you for the flattering intro. And again, I know that you brought this up in your intro, but I really meant it. It's been an honor to actually be interviewed on your show, and our conversations have been very valuable to me. In fact, you may recall that in the process of my writing my book, Jerk, you know, colorful title, How I Wasted My Life Watching Television, at least one of our interviews took place during the process of writing it. And actually, some of the things you said, and I'll be honest, I can't remember specifically how they informed the book as at this moment, but your conversation about the book and some of your ideas and insights had an impact and were valuable. And you know, there's nothing like good conversation. And hopefully, people listening to this will agree that this one will be one of those. Hopefully,
I hope, and I trust that I know that will be the case. Past precedent always is a strong indicator of what's going to come in the future, and so I know we're going to have more of that tonight. And it's funny. I mean, you talk about you know, the title of the book, Jerk. You know, if you wanted to get something in there in the book to sort of back up the point, I think a lot of people out there who are great aficionados of Seinfeld might perhaps embrace that title as well, given how you paint that you may have had a role in Jerry Seinfeld deciding to cancel the show. So I thought that was kind of funny.
You know, this was one, I mean, without taking up too much time on that story, although I don't mind, the one you're referring to is an indication of really why why this book, for me, was kind of a self-examination of the attitudes I adopted when I was a TV critic at the New York Post. And I mean, for want of a better way of putting it, I tended to develop a certain level of hubris. And it's almost necessary because you have to create story and column ideas every day, whether there is news or not. And the thing you're referring to is when we one day surveyed our readers in the beginning of the ninth and last season of Seinfeld and asked them if they thought the show wasn't as good as it had been for 8 seasons. And apparently this alarmed Jerry Seinfeld because he's a New Yorker and he saw it in the Post. And I don't think opinion was very strong either way among our readership, the people who responded to the poll we published in the TV section that day. Very innocuous thing, in my opinion. But later on in the year, he did call it quits, and that did become the last season. And he did say as his reason, you know, some of the criticism that had been started to, you know, sort of rise up from a standpoint of there having been no criticism of the show previously. Look, honestly, Rick, between you and me and actually everyone else who's listening, I hope it wasn't us that killed Seinfeld. I mean, really, it's a great show, and it's, as everyone knows, it's a legendary show, and it's lasted so long and thrown off so much money for the people involved. And it's just, you know, it could be, though, that it was ready to go anyway.
Well, I mean, it left at its peak. It definitely, if you helped it, you helped it to leave at its peak, and I guess that's what, for those of us who love the show, I guess we have to take something from that. It is kind of funny, though, because in your kind of lead up to the whole thing of like, has it lost its fastball, whatever, I gotta tell you, my favorite episode of all time happened early on in season 9, and it's funny because everybody I talk to agrees with me. Like, we don't know why the title of the show was The Voice, because that to me was one of the lesser subplots. We all think of Cramerica Industries and the giant ball of oil. That's my all-time favorite, Adam, and that was in that early season 9 run.
Yes, and it is a good episode in that great Seinfeldian way they had, particularly in the late seasons, where they the voice subplot notwithstanding, which actually, like you, it kind of mystifies me a little bit, but the way they were able to interlock, you know, Kramer's weird hiring of an intern and then inventing some sort of oil bladder with George's employment at the toy company. I mean, the whole thing was so interlocking and brilliantly done, but I also believe that you can't, and in fact that was proven that season, you can't keep that up.
It's
even
tough.
even with the gifted people, they up to that point they had done a ton of interlocking ones, and frankly my favorite, if I do have a favorite, was the yada yada.
Okay. Yeah.
And that involved Kramer and Mickey dating dwarfs, and it had that whole anti-Semitic parody with the anti-dentist plot line and jokes about Catholics and Jews. And the whole thing was so crazy. And it had Robert Wagner and Stephanie Powers in it. And, you know, the whole thing was really like a zenith. And it's difficult enough to do one of those episodes. But Seinfeld did dozens of them.
You know, it's so funny with that one being your favorite, because I go back to a previous conversation on the show with Curtis Armstrong where I said, you know, because his whole identity and his memoirs and everything like that was basically tied up in being Booger. And I said to him, I said, you know, I actually primarily think of you from Moonlighting. I loved Moonlighting. I watched every episode. I was a fanatic for that show. So you're kind of the same way here, Adam. If you like the anti-dentite thing, as opposed to Breaking Bad or Malcolm in the Middle, you probably primarily think of Bryan Cranston as the guy who said anti-dentite.
Some extent, but I think we do know him better for Breaking Bad. But it is interesting to me. You know, I had the privilege in my career of interviewing various people, and Bryan Cranston being one who I interviewed around the time that Breaking Bad first premiered. And whenever I come across these folks, I always, if they were in Seinfeld even once, I always added a question about Seinfeld, like, you know, what did that mean to your career, and did you know that show would still be watched today, and this kind of thing. And everybody always talks so fondly about having been on Seinfeld, and it did so much for them, and they enjoyed it so much, and it was very meaningful for them. And in my career, covering television since 1983, I mean, there's a lot of shows, but not that many. And I know that's sort of a conflict in terms, but guess there's sort of a, what you might call a large handful of shows that were significant and interesting to cover for years and years.
Well, and there's a number of notorious folks that you have covered over the course of your career, and I definitely wanted to take a look at that. The ones that you, again, your book serves as a good sort of focus just in terms of some of the things that you put in there, devoted chapters to, large swaths to, for the sake of this conversation, because you basically have interacted with really some of the top names in TV/pop culture over the course of your career, giving coverage of them, sometimes getting, you know, a little bit of pushback from time to time, if you will, on what your coverage of them has been. Two names from your book that you devote a decent amount of time to. I thought this was just interesting timing with our conversation coming up, because I started to watch over the weekend. I didn't get all the way through it, but I saw on Netflix David Letterman's new show on there. He did an episode with sitting down with Howard Stern, and I immediately thought, wow, two guys that Adam covered a lot, two guys that, you know, certainly have had a lot of thoughts over the course of their careers about the coverage that he devoted to them, and, you know, whether it be Letterman with the whole 90s ratings war with Leno that carried into the 2000s, everything with Howard Stern's career, his transition from radio into television, which I think was primarily where you were kind of covering him. And in looking at it, those two guys right there who you covered and who you sort of traced through their careers, they really did a lot, for better or for worse. Not everybody's a fan, but in terms of shaping modern television, pop culture, Letterman with the whole kind of sardonic persona of late night television. You know, Leno won the war commercially, but Letterman won the war critically. Everybody out there today is pretty much a descendant of David Letterman on the creative tree in late night television. And Howard Stern, you know, for better or for worse, I would say largely for worse, because there's nothing worse than a wannabe shock jock. He basically created an entire industry in his wake. These are two guys, again, early 80s, right when you were starting to cover TV, that's when they were starting to break out. So you've seen it all through their careers.
Well, it's true. And it is interesting to see them in conversation with each other. And in fact, one of the great highlights of the Letterman show on CBS, and probably on NBC, although I can remember the CBS shows a little better, was any time that Howard Stern was on. And there's something about that, you know, there's something, as I've always said about Howard Stern, I used to have these battles with him where, you know, I'd write some really critical column in the New York Post just because I knew that he would whine about it on the air the next day. Mm-hmm. And he would usually do that, and you know, he would say how he hated me and this kind of stuff. And I never knew him personally. I think I ran into him in person once, and it was perfectly cordial, to tell you the truth. It was very brief too.
Uh-huh.
But yeah, it's true that they were two. They are two of the really most influential titans of the years that I covered TV and radio. I mean, I wrote about radio at about the beginning of Howard Stern's career.
Right.
And the beginning of shock radio and all that kind of stuff. And the thing I always loved about Stern on Letterman was that Stern apparently shared with me, I mean, he didn't know this, but we had in common a fascination with late night television.
Sure.
So whenever Stern would go on Letterman, and previously when he would go on Leno, but then at some point he decided he hated Jay Leno, so he wouldn't go on a show anymore, they always talked about late night. And one of the great things about it was that Letterman didn't really want to go on and on about the late night wars, but Stern insisted that they do, because he was Stern. And they would always have these great conversations where David sort of sit there saying, I don't really want to talk about that. And Stern would say, don't you really hate Leno? Isn't he the biggest jerk? And Stern once said, Dave, I can't not talk about late night. I follow this like it's the Torah. You know, because he's a Jewish guy from Long Island.
Sure.
And it's just really, interesting to me, Howard Stern's fascination with show business. And I'll say this about Howard Stern, and it wasn't emphasized enough in my coverage, but I did bring this up from time to time. He was a real great broadcaster. And I don't mean he's in the past tense, but he does something different today than when he was on, you know, syndicated on morning radio stations, when morning radio was a real thing. And one of the things he was very professional about was doing a great job for his sponsors. And one of the lost arts we have, I guess it's still done in some realms of television and radio, but not very often, is the air personality who voices the commercials personally. And this is something I hugely respected with him. When Howard Stern would do his own sort of off-the-cuff ad-lib commercials about, like, some Long Island waterbed store. I mean, this was the most effective salesmanship. You wanted to go out there and buy a waterbed that day. I mean, he was really good at it, and that's an old, old broadcasting tradition. And, you know, you think Howard Stern is such a rebel, you know, with his long hair and everything, but he was a student of traditional radio, is really what the secret was with that guy. I had massive respect for the way he broadcasted,
well,
for the voice that he had.
You know, there's something they have in common in that way, Adam, because, again, we used to talk about 1230 Dave versus 1130 Dave. You look at Howard Stern, you talked about how he's evolved in the course of his career. We had a conversation on the show recently with Jackie the Joke Man Martling, where, again, I certainly subscribe to the point of view. It ain't what it was back in the day when he was on there. Billy West, who I always felt was just an insanely underrated contributor to that show. That was the time when I really, really enjoyed listening to it. Billy West with the imitations and all of that kind of stuff. But again, you know, as much as I think it was better at that point in time, it just sort of backs up my point. Both Letterman and Stern, in ways that are underrated for each of them, I think, have been chameleons throughout pop culture in these 35 years and been able to adapt.
Yes, and not only that, and in fact, that's the key to the reason why they are such titans or icons, because of their lasting quality. I mean, Howard Stern's been on TV on radio a long time.
Yeah.
I mean, and I remember when he would occasionally do interviews, I mean, not with me, but there'd be interviews when he was at the height of his morning radio show, you know, and he would say, in all honesty, and he probably talked about this on the radio, because he was always so honest about his life and how this even contributed to the collapse of his marriage and things like this. You know, broadcasting is an exhausting thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
If you're Howard Stern, you're tired every day, because that kind of contentious 4 or 4.5 hours of work starting in the early morning can wipe you out.
Right.
And in a way, the endurance is not only an ability to, as you say, you know, adapt to cultural changes or in his case, help bring them about in sort of a gradual way. But it's also sheer physical and mental willpower to get through that kind of thing. And Letterman, too. You know, I think Johnny Carson was in some weird way kind of nuts for doing a show every day. And it made him kind of crazy. It made him, I mean, not crazy like he was a lunatic who was, you know, sitting in his office babbling to himself. But I mean, it makes them wary of the public. And they kind of live relatively reclusive lives, even though money helps pay for those reclusions, and they do have friends and things like this. But it's a very interesting lifestyle that even in all the years I've covered people like this and observed them from the outside, I still don't have a full understanding of what their lives are like.
Sure.
I mean, Dave was on for an hour every day, and during the rest of the day, I understand that in the offices of the Ed Sullivan Theater, very few people really spoke to Dave.
Yeah,
and this is what I always say, to people. You know, this came up as recently as a year or two ago, when you know the Steve Harvey's memo got publicized.
Mm-hmm.
That he put out that memo where he told people in the office, "You got to stop waylaying me in the hallway asking for selfies and autographs. It's ridiculous." And everybody came out against Steve Harvey, and I wrote a column that said, "Come on, the thing he does is hard work. If he's going from place to place, it means he's thinking about what he has to say on TV."
Right.
So if you stop him for a selfie, you know, you have no idea what goes into this work. Broadcasting
right.
was hard work. It might still be for some. And this is the respect I have for people like Letterman and Stern. Really, like broadcasting Hall of Famers.
Yes. They've been two of the defining figures, I think, in television/pop culture, clearly, in your 35 years of covering it, and something you and I had discussed this off air a little bit, sort of a little bit of a theory that I had about the period of time and when you got into covering television. I mean, I know that we can say that, again, in the, I guess even from the very beginnings of television, there were things that, you know, people coast to coast would watch, and you know, it's people are baffled to hear about it today in some circles, but pro wrestling on the Dumont back in the 50s, that was a thing that was a craze. And there were things like that. And even into the 70s with, you know, whether it be Happy Days being a big hit, MASH, the series finale for MASH, every year for around the time of the Super Bowl, you always see highest rated shows of all time, and the MASH series finale was in there. But I think we really didn't even have a sense when you were starting your career of how much cable was going to do to just go so far past what we thought television had the ability to do as far as culturally, but not necessarily putting everybody on the same page as far as believing stuff, but imitating stuff, being into certain crazes, whatever. And I know I said to you off air that, you know, in the late 80s when I was downstate in Ohio and I was in a rural area and I saw kids that were dressed like the kids at the mall back in suburban Cleveland, I was just like, wow, this is like, I just thought in my head, this must be like the MTV effect, you know? And you started to really kind of see that in the way that cable television, right from when you started covering it in the early 80s, boom, that's been one of the biggest things, I think, as far as a unifying kind of thing with pop culture. The internet has amplified it, but cable television, starting with when you were covering TV, really is what launched the snowball down the hill.
Well, it is interesting, too, that is true, and particularly with, you're talking about sort of like, part of what you just said referred to cultural trends, perhaps, ushered in by MTV, which was one of the earliest successes in sort of breaking a certain demographic group off of the network television pie.
Right.
It was younger people. Now, at the time and for many years, MTV was the exception, not the rule. Cable did take a while, and I have to hand it to the cable industry generally for sort of hanging in there and getting the country wired. I mean, in the late 80s, Rick, I lived in Queens, New York, and I still didn't have cable because it was not in our neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
So I mean, to me, that's relatively recent history. And indeed, the work I did in the 80s covering television, it was still largely focused on the large networks.
Right.
We had some companies building cable channels. CNN had been around since 1980, and I think HBO had been also. And broadcast TV was where it was at, and this was reflected really in one of the sidelights of things that I covered over the years was, at that time in the mid to late 80s, the value of broadcast television stations, and indeed radio stations too, really reached a kind of all-time high for then. I mean, it's more now, but for then, and that's because television was still king, and they weren't making any more stations. So it was like the price could only go up if you wanted to buy and sell television stations. And it might have been the last era where the old fashioned broadcast TV was really still king, and they lived like it too. They had, you know, they had their private dining rooms and the network headquarters buildings, and they took limousines everywhere. This kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I just don't think there's as much of that today.
No.
And let's face it, the fractioning off of audience segments that started to take place then, it's almost like a free-for-all now. So much so that it's almost like a miracle that network TV still kind of holds its own as at least where advertisers and at least some segments of the audience are concerned, it's still the top dog. You know, the Super Bowl is still on broadcast TV.
Right.
You know, it's not on the internet. And there's a lot of other issues with the internet that sort of prevent it for the moment from overtaking network television. These are technological issues, you know, viewability and the like. But if there was one theme, as you point out, from 1983 to the present, it was that there used to be very few channels, and therefore the bulk of the business went to them. And the business is, of course, the sale of advertising time. And over the years, it's sort of like if that was the wide end of a funnel.
Right.
It got gradually narrower until here we are in the present day, where the formerly dominant networks, I mean, there weren't even three of them anymore, there's four, and many cable networks that get audiences that are close in proximity to what the big networks get. And so, you know, what it has really created is millions of more viewers and billions of more dollars in advertising sales. So it's like it brings more people to television generally, and I think that's good for the business.
Yes.
If you're in the business. No, I'm not in the business, and So for me, as a journalist, it's always been interesting to observe these things, fully realizing that I don't really know how to do it myself. So it's an interesting dynamic.
It is. It certainly is. And, you know, I'm going to put a pin in that because I want to come back to what you were saying about how it sort of transitioned into today's television, because as I said to you off air, I think we're on the verge of something right now that's as transformative as cable became in the 80s. But to go back for just a second here, this was another thing you'd said to me off air. It was a very interesting and refreshing kind of contrarian point that you made about the so-called new golden age of TV, notwithstanding the fact that you had recommended to me, and I really appreciated your recommendation a couple of years back, that fine book that Alan Sepinwall wrote, your colleague in the industry, about that. And boy, it lived up to your recommendation of it, let me tell you. I thought it was really excellent. And many of those shows are shows that I greatly enjoyed watching. I've never had HBO, so I've never gotten to see any of those shows aside from the occasional one here and there. But aside from the HBO, although I take that back, I got Deadwood subsequently on DVD, so I was able to watch it that way. But that was a great book. But you made an interesting sort of pushback when we were talking off air about this, and that there is a discounting that people sometimes do. Not to say that Alan did that, but that others may make in terms of discounting. You were talking about in the 80s that, again, cable was coming. Cable was the future, but the networks were still largely king at that point, more than they would be in any of the times since. You were talking about Hill Street Blues, Saint Elsewhere, and it's an interesting kind of a thing where I think toward the beginning of the new millennium, you got to a thing where I think this sort of, especially with cable and with HBO and some of these channels, of where high quality was sort of like a niche thing that that the programmers started paying for, versus it's interesting that in the 80s, I don't know that high quality and anything like that, it may have been part of the pitch when they were selling these shows, I don't know, but it seems to me it just sort of more played out that way. But those two that you cited, Hill Street Blues, St. Elsewhere, there's a few other ones in the 80s, I think, that fit into that as well. That we've seen, as you pointed out to me, great episodes, great periods of television previously. Today kind of tends to get a lot of the ink, but it's not the first time.
No, and this is very unscientific. It's sort of like looking at these things in terms of percentages. For example, the golden age that people talk about that was recent, in my view, began when The Sopranos premiered in around 1999, mm-hmm. and maybe it continued through the mid-2000s, and there are some exceptions, with perhaps Breaking Bad, and Breaking Bad ended when, Rick, 2011 or something, or maybe later than that, but
around it.
But, and there's some great shows now that couldn't have been around 20 years ago, like Game of Thrones, and that's still with us, but there were a handful of shows, I won't go into the full list, that I think that came around and started the ball rolling from 1999 to around 2005, and for that group of that kind of show, sure, it was a golden age. They broke taboos, and the filmmaking was of a different quality, and this was in many ways technology-driven. Also driven by, you know, in the case of The Sopranos, which is my favorite example of this, the money and the sort of creative freedom that HBO gave David Chase and his producers and writers to take their sweet time and really do whatever they want for however much they needed to do it was unprecedented. And I think it was an incredible way to make television that no one who made television before was ever willing to do. You know, sort of like open up the money faucet and just let it run. And the rewards were great. Now, at the same time, however, there was all the other television. And television is this great monster with a giant appetite, and you have to fill it with stuff. And, you know, during the time when all these Golden Age shows were on, the Deadwood, as you mentioned, and The Sopranos, and Six Feet Under, and Dexter on Showtime, and Weeds on Showtime, and The Shield, and perhaps one of my favorite shows in the whole time I covered television on FX. You know what else is going on? Ridiculous reality shows where men were racing camels and foot races, and midgets or dwarfs, I should say, were looking for love on you know, the I Married a Dwarf show or whatever they had, and there was Who Wants to Marry a Multimillionaire and other crazy catastrophes, and two-hour food-eating contests on Fox. Remember all that stuff?
Right.
So at the same time, television, you can't define that period of television as a whole, as being, you know, coated in a golden age. To me, it was the same kind of free-for-all that television had long been, only more so. And maybe it's because of the rise of reality television. And in fact, that period of reality television would probably be a pretty good subject for a book, sort of in the way that Alan Siebenwall wrote that book about, you know, the golden age television shows and the people who made them. Because that was a crazy Wild West kind of a scene, starting with Survivor.
Yes.
And leading into everything else. And nobody's going around calling that a golden age. If nothing else, it was the antithesis. And because of the growth of cable, you had an awful lot of cheap reality shows all over the place. And, you still do. So I try not to think in terms of golden ages, but I think that in every era, as you mentioned, there are shows, when I think back in the great moments and great scenes of my career, and even in the before that, when I was just a guy watching TV and growing up and watching it, there's so much high quality that there's always a standout show in any era. You take a sitcom like Taxi,
mm-hmm.
and it's a very special experience to watch that show.
Yes.
There's a great deal of warmth, a great deal of comedy. They took a lot of chances. And like you say, Hill Street Blues was in the same era. And, you know, as usual in these conversations, I'm not that facile that I can pick titles out of the air and point them out to people. But you had really television writers like Stephen Bochco and David E. Kelly first making their names. And everything they did was different and interesting and not always successful. But you know, and you even go back to beloved shows such as The Rockford Files, you know, from the 70s. And that is a very well-written show and a very well-made show. And there's nothing not golden agey about it, except that people can be a little snobby and say, well, that was just some network show.
Sure.
But not really. It was really a great show. And look, one of the things we benefit from in our multi-channel world is the ability to see all these shows. They're everywhere, and there's all these digital sub-channels now with old television shows, and it's one reason why I've become re-familiarized with a whole group of them. And, you know, pound for pound, you know what, in my view, the best show in the history of television probably is, pound for pound?
What do you think?
The Twilight Zone.
Okay, same thing Vince Gilligan said.
I mean, it's not easy, even as if I have to make a case for it by saying it's because I enjoy this episode or that episode. It's just that the overall consistency and the weirdness and just the fact that they made this thing with this grim-faced guy, you know, who was a brilliant writer and chain-smoking genius, and, you know, it's the things they commented on,
yeah,
in those stories that they wrote. I mean, it's just, and this realization only came to me recently, Rick, when I was, I don't know, I guess I was watching a Twilight Zone marathon or something,
mm-hmm.
you know, one of the holidays, the Sci-Fi Channel runs this, and I thought, you know, this, of all the shows that I really don't even know that well, this thing is where it's at. This is the show, The Twilight Zone.
That
this isn't our whole world a Twilight Zone, Rick. I mean,
yeah.
Really, you know, it's like that show hit the nail on the head.
Right.
It just did. You
right.
Know?
It was incredible.
And we can all make arguments for The Honeymooners and for Seinfeld and, you know,
right.
The Sopranos and all kind of stuff, but really, nothing took a chance like The Twilight Zone. I don't think there's ever been anything like it.
I don't think so either, and I'll tell you what, yeah. when you talk about not painting with a broad brush, in terms of, say, golden age of television, one of the shows, and you mentioned it there, and it's a show that I didn't get to see at the time, but I watched subsequently. I binged the whole show in like 25 days, The Shield, and I thought it was awesome. And one of my great joys was I actually tweeted at Jay Carnes, and I said, you know, the Dutchman was my favorite character, great job. And he actually responded, so that was very nice.
It was a great character, and really one of the most amazing things about that show was just the grittiness and the sort of the dirt that came off of every scene and the you know, the thing that struck me was the locations they made it in.
Yeah.
I mean, some of the homeliest neighborhoods you could ever film a television show in.
Yeah, but it worked.
And
it worked.
Yeah, it did. And they had a bravura way of, you know, they would like, they must have cameramen who must have been like in the Olympics or something, because they would run after the SHIELD police when they were chasing a perp, and they were right behind them on their backs, and it was just
sure.
Really, you know, just a very exciting and here again, because of technology and because of a certain amount of creative freedom, they were able to create something that we had never seen before. Now, one of the things that came along with it, as you know, that I write about in my book, is the violence and the language and the overall,
yes,
the overall, well, I mean, to put it lightly, a negative take on the world we live in.
Sure.
And I don't know what the value is for the regular people to be watching this kind of stuff all the time. I'm not a sociologist. I know that for me it began to bother me over time.
No, I agree with that. I agree. I'm not going to say it's healthy for society as far as all the different elements that are out there, but, you know, as far as not painting with a broad brush, you look at somebody where if I was to canvass my friends or FDH Lounge contributors or whatever, I think I would get the most votes for this guy if I was to say, tell me who you think the greatest actor of his generation is, and that would be people, I guess, more or less about my own age. I think more people than anybody else would say Walton Goggins. And yet, The Shield, Justified, he also did Vice Principals. So you can't paint with a broad brush on anything, Adam.
You know, it's interesting you bring up a guy like him. He's, as you were nice enough to mention earlier, I've had the opportunity to meet and interview a whole ton of people.
Yes.
Over the years. And as I tell people, you know, people will ask me sometimes, who did you meet? Did you meet this one? Do you know that one? I would tell people, now, wait a minute. 99.9% of them, I have a phone interview with them, or if I'm lucky, I meet them in some hotel restaurant with a publicist, and we have our fun, we do our interview. And so I'm acquainted with them in the vaguest kind of way. Well, one day I interviewed Walt Goggins about The Shield. I think it was about the death of his character was coming up in a show.
Uh-huh.
And he's a great guy. And I got a letter from his mother after it was published. And she wanted a copy of it because she had seen it maybe online or something. She said, she wrote to me from Georgia, where he's from, and, you know, would you send me a copy? I'm Walton Goggins' mother, and he's real excited about the story you did on him. And ever since, every once in a blue moon, I correspond with Walt Goggins, you know? So it's interesting you would bring him up. And he's the kind of actor that maybe TV might not have attracted unless it had this kind of, like, really challenging material to offer a guy like that.
Well, I'll tell you what, that's an amazing point, and I'll tell you what, you know who's going to his eyes are going to pop out when he hears this is our FDH senior editor, Jason Jones, who, like me, really puts Walt Goggins on a pedestal. And it's funny because what Jason and I were doing at one point in time here, it's funny because the stuff that Adam was doing, like with that book, and when he started getting into the long form blog reviews and interacting with the commenters, is that he really sort of kind of influenced a lot of today's kind of interactive reviewing culture. It had always been sort of a top down kind of a thing out there. You guys in the newspapers, you know, the voice of God and everything like that. For better or for worse, today it's a more democratized scene. You've got a lot of the bloggers out there, the commenters and everything. And when we were first creating the FDH Lounge show, Jason and myself, the way we conceptualized it, of course, spinning off of FantasyDraftHelp.com and doing a show for that, we wanted to take the analysis of sports and apply it to essentially everything. And I think the purest manifestation we ever had was for 2 years there, the last two seasons of Justified, he and I were recording the shows, and there would be a brief delay, maybe an hour or so, while I would process it and then upload it. But we were recording in real time as soon as they went off the air. And I remember one night, there was, I think it was the scene with when he met Dewey Crow's cousin for the first time, Michael Rapaport's character. And there was a line reading from that where Jason said, if I was working on the set, like as a grip or something like that, I would have run up and high-fived Walton Goggins as soon as they yelled cut, because it was just awesome. So, you know, it's just, you know, there's nothing more visceral than reviewing something in real time. And that's a culture I think we've seen over the course of the last decade or so, of the way that people are really sinking their teeth into these shows and wanting to have their voices and opinions heard on it.
Yeah, that's true, and it is the twilight of the influential critic. And while I sometimes mourn this, I also realize there's nothing that I can do to, or anybody can do to, you know, stave off an evolution. But it is true that at the height of at least my career, maybe in the '90s or early 2000s, I was And look, I had a pretty pumped up attitude about it too, which was not the healthiest thing in the world. But I realized that since I worked at one of the top, let's say, 10 papers in terms of circulation in the United States, I was certainly on the lion's share end of attention from the publicity apparatus in the television business, because they valued, that is, if I was going to cover them positively, they valued what I had to say because many people would read it. And they feared what I had to say if it was a negative review or story. And indeed, there was only a handful of these, and we felt, you know, those of us who did it felt like we were sort of the big cheeses. And, you know, we felt that we had the best line on everything. And it is interesting how that kind of print journalism, where, as you say, reviewing a show while it's on, like every line or every scene, it was not possible.
Sure.
And we had sort of like what you might call exclusive access to these kinds of platforms and the material needed to watch to in order to write these things. You know, we felt kind of special about it. I will say this about that era. I was glad that I worked in newspapers before they started to crater, because that was, I guess I was one of the last generation of people who worked at papers when they still, in the case of the New York Post, could circulate 650,000 a day.
Yep.
I'd be surprised if they sell 100,000 today.
Yep.
And you pick the thing up and it's like five pages or something, you know. So I say this much: it sure was fun.
Absolutely, sure. And you know,
and to have had that experience and to have been lucky enough to have that experience. So
and you were part of that, Adam. Absolutely, all the way through, and you know, pretty much again to when newspapers were dominant, and of course you made the switch to digital because you had to, because as you said, newspapers are a dying business. Digital is where it's at, and you know that sort of goes to what I was alluding to before, as far as this age that we're in now, and streaming over the top television, and where we're at with this. It is you had said earlier, and I agree with you because this may or may not have been the way you were thinking of, or maybe it was one way you were thinking of it, or maybe not at all the way you were thinking of it. But the whole thing of just network television as appointment viewing anymore. And it is getting to be increasingly obsolete. And it's one of the reasons that sports entities and WWE, based on their contracts recently, have been able to haul in as much, because those are the only things considered to be DVR-proof, essentially, except for the biggest of shows that really kind of keep people on the edge of their seat. I can't wait for next Sunday night at 10 o'clock, because we're moving to a world where, and I'm almost surprised it hasn't happened yet, because this had been forecast by some people years ago. You know, it'll just be a thing of where the network will upload it at a certain point in time during the week, and people will watch it from then on. I guess that's kind of where we're at now with the apps and with DVRing and whatever, and maybe that's the form that it's going to take, is where it'll always be available to watch live as far as some of these shows go, and as well as on demand. But what we're veering away from that, we're veering more towards on demand. I know a lot of people aren't as comfortable as I am watching shows on a phone or tablet or whatever. I watch shows on different devices. I've got my streaming things hooked up basically to every device that I've got. So, you know, we're in an era where you said before about the wild, wild west. It really kind of applies to today, this explosion that we have. And, you know, I could say, you know, from my point of view personally, you know, as a would-be creator, it's a great time to be alive in terms of the number of places that are out there vying for content. But, you know, much as cable really kind of changed the game, more so, as you said, eventually, not right off the bat in the early 80s, when you started getting in there, here, as you're heading into where you go in the next, shall we say, the next 35 years of your career, Adam? But in terms of that, or however long it goes, well, kind of sitting at the beginning of another new era.
Well, I appreciate you, you know, predicting that I'll be doing this for 35 years or even 2 years. But, and again, I just want to emphasize, it's not about, you know, what Adam Buckman feels about TV in any era. I hope everybody enjoys themselves and gets what they want or can get out of whatever they choose to view on network TV or on streaming services. But for me, Rick, I'm 59 this year, and I'm still going to do this for a couple of years, but I am at the point where I've seen enough television, and it's possible that, I mean, I subtitled the book, How I Wasted My Life Watching Television, which was, of course, the opposite of what I think. It's facetious. But I also think that I have not yet formed the habit of setting up my devices to watch streaming services. There are tons of new shows coming out all the time that I never watch. I guess in some ways I'm mercenary like that. The people I work for don't seem to care if I don't cover, cover the Netflix shows and things like that. So I don't, and it's not any animus toward Netflix. It's just that my TV watching has become so compartmentalized to, like, primarily what is easy for me to access, what won't stir up my brain too much, and what I might use as a column topic,
mm-hmm.
which is to say, I think that everybody, when they reach a certain age, they want to retire and do something different, perhaps. And I'm pretty sure that I won't be spending the next 35 years, even if it were possible to live that long, watching television. I think that for someone like me, from my era, the new era belongs to other people, and I'm fine with that. I had this conversation the other day. I was actually at breakfast with someone who runs a couple of the cable networks. I mean, and again, I don't mean to sound like I go around having these breakfasts all the time. this was kind of an exception. And he's a really good guy, and we've been trying to get together. And he himself said, when he goes home at night, he doesn't want to sit there and scroll through the Roku menus and things like this. And I find them sort of almost like more, less than the passive sort of TV viewing experience I like to have.
Sure.
I'd rather, and then for many people, yes, the press is full of these ideas that time shifting is going to take over everything and that the schedules won't matter. But that has yet to be fulfilled. For an awful lot of people, television is just television. And let's face it, prime time is when most people are home watching television.
Right.
It is also true that network TV researchers will tell you this, Rick. It's the 10 p.m. dramas on the networks that have been impacted the most by people recording or time-shifting their viewing and then watching shows they recorded or want to watch on streaming between 10 and 11 p.m.
Okay.
For some reason, this has become the habit of people. Hmm. That's measurable by people who do this kind of research in the television business.
Interesting.
And this has been going on actually for a couple of years, as far back as when NBC tried to put Jay Leno on every night at 10 o'clock. This was one of the reasons why they did that, because 10 o'clock dramas were already feeling the effects of people's changing viewing habits. I mean, you could always take the old-fashioned approach and say, well, you know, the answer to that is put on better shows at 10 to 11 than the people have access to stream and to record.
Right.
But that's always the object and the goal, but that's easier said than done. So in that regard, it has taken over and had an impact, a dent, if you will.
Yes.
But it's not a foregone conclusion that everything will become that way soon. But I think it will in 10, 15 years. Particularly because of the younger generation of people.
Right.
I mean, there might not even be, do you know any teenagers?
Yeah, definitely.
All they watch is YouTube.
Right.
That's all I ever see them with. I don't even think they've ever heard of a television show.
Well,
or something.
Well, here's the funny thing, Adam, is that, YouTube is a means also, and yeah, there's the ways you're thinking of and I'm thinking of, but also for curating various forms of television. For example, I'll tell you this. Like last year, I was kind of feeling nostalgic, and it's one of these things where when you watch something on a subject, you start getting bombarded with other clips from it, so you fall further down the rat hole. That's how it is with me. I fell down a 9/11 rat hole at one point watching coverage from that day. Last year, I fell down a rat hole of old Guiding Light because I used to enjoy watching that when it was on. It was the only soap opera I ever watched. I'll tell you this, I never watched As the World Turns. I've recently fallen down an As the World Turns rat hole. So, you can find
like
traditional
all on
TV.
Or something?
Pardon?
They're all on YouTube.
Yeah,
they're
clips. Clips, playlists. People who are big fans they will put together, they'll curate things. Like, you know, if you want to see this storyline, you can see it play out. So traditional television in untraditional ways, it's completely the opposite of, and again, I don't think you were doing much with covering daytime television back in the day, but if you ever were, this is a completely different form of watching stuff. And you, it's sort of like a best of, a condensed version of the hottest storylines, the best stories that were being told. And yeah, so it's like, I know what you're saying about teenagers, and they're probably not watching old As the World Turns. They're watching other people play video games, which is something I, you know, I'm the old guy who doesn't get that, but that's another story for another day.
But on the other hand, when they get older, they may seek out the compelling dramas and adult comedies that are making a splash all over television. So
it may be.
This is why I say, I often say that predictions are a little difficult. For example, Rick, as you know, the network TV business about a month ago had their upfront season.
Yes.
Where they had these glitzy things, these presentations in New York, and all the advertising community comes, and they introduce their new shows and tried out all the stars on stages. You know, this is a pretty big deal, and in fact, the trade press in the advertising world has been reporting the last few weeks that the broadcast networks, despite the fact that all these other sources of video continue to chip away at their dominance and their audiences, are getting double-digit increases in the prices they're charging for ad time.
Remarkable.
I mean, double-digit is not 50%, but it's like whatever over 10 is, you know?
Yeah.
But that's amazing.
It is.
And that's incredible. And it's because when all is said and done, they might have a smaller audience than they used to for their, as we call in the business, linear television, you know, television that is scheduled.
Right.
You know, in time slots. And they might have a steadily decreasing audience for that. But it's still the biggest audience where big advertisers can reach the most people. Now, if the evolution continues, though, there will come a tipping point where it just won't, where TV commercials will not be effective anymore.
Right.
But for some reason that even I can't explain after covering it for this long, the TV commercial is the best kind of advertising that there is.
Yeah.
So, I mean, Facebook and Google can make billions in advertising, but nobody's really bragging about the great advertising that's on those sites.
That's right.
So there's just something about television. So I'm not ready to write off linear TV yet, but there is an inevitability to it, because if audiences continue to decrease, it's not as if they decrease 1 year and then they increase the next year.
Exactly.
You know, it's just it's a downward graph that's been going on as you pointed out earlier, since the 80s. But it's very gradual, and in the meantime, everybody I know who's in the television business is rich.
Right.
So something must be going on that's right.
Well, you're right.
You know, and indeed, as I sometimes write, TV is everywhere.
Yes.
So if you're running a business in which that is everywhere, now it's in the palm of everybody's hands, in addition to being in every dry cleaner, bar, restaurant, and airport gate. You know, TV is omnipresent.
It is.
So how could you not make money from it?
It is.
How could not be, you know? So that's the state of TV now. And personally, I've been overloaded. In the future, maybe I'll just be able to pick and choose, perhaps from the very menus we're talking about, things that will be more suited to my life of leisure.
Maybe so, yes. But again, a wild ride it's been for you in covering TV all those years. And as I said earlier on, you know, MASH, I think it was 1982, whatever year it was, maybe it was 83, that it drew, I think, the highest rating of all time. And again, that is something that will never be beaten except by like a Super Bowl, because the splintering really sort of began from there with cable. Now the splintering has just continued with the streaming services as well.
And,
you know, 83 being the first year you wrote your first TV column in July of then, you know, again, your career, a really interesting sort of view on the world of all of these changes here. And again, I can't tell everybody enough, go out there, Amazon, other places, it's there. Jerk, How I Wasted My Life Watching Television. And again, fascinating stories from there. Fascinating conversation. And I know, Adam, that you're always a guy that you're among the more thoughtful regulars that we have, and that's out of a thoughtful group. So I'm sure you were sitting there prepping and thinking about things you wanted to say. If there's anything, if there's any points that we got to, I don't want you to leave it on the cutting room floor. So did we miss anything that you thought would be of interest in this conversation?
No, I thought it was great. And I'm really, like I said, I'm just flattered when anybody wants to talk to me about television. And you've been a great supporter of mine. I just really appreciate your help.
Well, I would say a big fan, Adam. And again, very flattering the regard in which you hold the show and me. And I can't thank you enough for that. Very, very validating. And again, what better feeling could I have doing mini episode 999 than to do it with you, to trace the evolution of television through your 35 years of covering it. And again, no matter how many years of TV you got left in front of you, no matter how many mini episodes we got left in front of us, I want you to always be a part of it. I look forward to the next time you're back on, and thank you so much for your time, as always, my friend.
Me too. Have a great night, and thank you so much. We'll speak soon.
We will. Thank you, Adam. Thank you, everybody, for tuning in to FDH Lounge mini episode number 999.
As we bring the show to a close, we would like to extend our deepest gratitude to NBC, CBS, ABC, Fox, all Clear Channel affiliates, TNT, TBS, USA, UPN, Deadspin.com, YouTube.com, YTMND.com, MySpace.com, various blogs, Fox News, CNN, CNBC, MSNBC, IamBored.com, Billboard.com, Google.com, ESPN, ESPN2, ESPN News, ESPN Classic, NBA TV, NFL Network, Sports Time Ohio, Athlon Magazine, Comedy Central, Cartoon Network, The Boomerang Channel, QVC, BET, The Spice Channel, Steno Notebooks, Manwich, Papermate Office Supplies, Waitresses, Strippers, Bartenders, Garbage Men, Janitors, Microwave Popcorn, The Writers of The Office, Scrubs, Entourage, My Name is Earl, Oz, Metalocalypse and the Boondocks, Awkwafina, and The Periodic Table of Elements.